This is session 153, towards an LDS count of physician-assisted suicide. We have for us today the presenter is Samuel Brown, and just a little bit of biographical information about Samuel Brown. He's an assistant professor of pulmonary and critical care medicine and a division associate in the Medical Ethics and Humanities at the Intermountain Medical Center at the University of Utah. His research interests and publications include epidemiology and physiology of life-threatening infections, ethic considerations for the end of life, and the cultural history of embodiment of death and the afterlife. His book on the cultural and theological history of death and the afterlife in early Mormonism is currently under review at the university.
It's actually forthcoming.
It's been this past
2011.
It has a publication date, fall of 2011. And Samuel lives in Salt Lake City with his wife, Kate Holbrook, a doctor candidate in religious studies at Boston University. They maintain several children and a small but fruitful garden. And so that's the introduction we have so far. I'm looking forward to this session particularly because I recently, it's a little plug for Netflix. On Netflix, I watched the movie Kevorkian with Al Pacino.
Oh,
and I thought it really made you think about things that, in ways that most TV shows don't. And so I don't know whether your presentation will have any remnants of that same thing or not, but it sure makes people think about the assumptions that we all have in life, about life and death. And so I'll turn the time over to Samuel right now, and he can, he's got a PowerPoint presentation, and he's going to talk about this topic.
Thanks.
Yeah, it was called You Don't Know Jack. That was a good...
You Don't Know Jack?
Yeah.
There you go. I will try to avoid Al Pacino impersonations during the talk. Thanks for coming. I hope that in this talk and then the conversation that ensues afterwards, we can talk thoughtfully and respectfully about very important and very difficult to discuss issues surrounding the time that we exit this mortal coil. And I would like to give you a sense. I'm a medical researcher and physician. We like to do fairly methodical PowerPoint presentations. And I want to give you a sense from this roadmap slide what we'll talk about. I'd like to frame our discussions with a vignette. It's an entirely manufactured vignette. Give you just a brief sense of the history in the West of the notion of suicide, and then talk about physician-assisted suicide, which is a very small but very influential subset of the discussion about suicide. And then I want to talk primarily today about LDS perspectives or possible LDS perspectives on this increasingly controversial but increasingly prominent idea in American discussions, then a few thought experiments. And I find when you actually frame it in terms of individuals that you can imagine as actual people making actual decisions, that the abstract ethics become quite concrete and sometimes very productive. And finally, I want to close with an image of sliding slopes that I think is probably relevant to the final decisions we make about the meanings of physician-assisted suicide. This is Roger, age 43, fairly typical of people with this disease, but not anyone I've ever met. He's the oldest son of someone who died of Huntington's disease, which is a progressively fatal movement disorder, and dementia generally takes sufferers over the course of 2 to 5 years and can be diagnosed genetically before it ever appears. So Roger, because his father was afflicted, was tested genetically and was found to have the genetic abnormality that gives a 95% chance of dying of Huntington's disease. With that knowledge, he begins to notice that his arms are moving strangely, which is often the first indication of Huntington's disease. With that information, goes to the neurologist. Diagnosis is confirmed. Roger saw his father die from Huntington's and requests that his physician prescribe secobarbital. Secobarbital is a barbiturate. It's an older barbiturate. And the distinguishing characteristic of secobarbital is that it can be given in a high enough dose in a small enough pill that you can actually swallow enough to pass. And it is generally, when people commit physician-assisted suicide, that generally is how they do it, by taking a tablet or several of secobarbital. So Roger knows the story, and he has had a productive and gratifying life, but feels that the time has passed. He turns to his physician, who's a practicing Latter-day Saint, and she says, "No, I can refer you to a hospice, but I'm not comfortable providing you a prescription for secarbibertol, not least because it's formally illegal in the state where they live, but they could also be in Washington or Oregon." A week later, Roger found other means and passed at his own hand. It's the vignette to frame it. Let's talk a little bit about this ending your life prematurely of your own volition. This is West, Death on a Pale Horse. This is an apocalyptic painting that was making the rounds in Antebellum America. And Joseph Smith actually had at least temporarily access to this painting and reflected on it once. And I think it's a fascinating image of what people might intend by the end of the world and perhaps their own ends.
The month he died.
Yes, yes. A portent. Plato and Aristotle wrote a fair bit about suicide, not exhaustively, but a fair bit. And for them, suicide was considered a disgrace. They did not advocate suicide. They did frame it primarily in social terms. It wasn't a question of the autonomy of the individual's decision to end or not to end life, but a question of how the polis, the city or community, would exist on the basis of the suicide. And what's interesting to me is that at the same time they say suicide is a terrible idea, they say it's allowed in four exceptional cases. One is if you have a morally corrupt mind. There's your answer to Malthus, right? Zero population. Judicial order, such as Socrates, who was told to commit suicide and did so. Extreme and unavoidable personal misfortune and shame from a disgraceful action of a person who generally has a morally reasonable mind. So this is an interesting set of exceptions that to us now would seem, if we substitute psychiatric disease such as severe depression for this morally corrupt mind, would describe most of the reasons we think people commit suicide and ought not to commit suicide. Christianity, actually, if you read the canon of Christianity, doesn't actually have any statement about suicide. It is based on a God-man figure who embraced his own death in order to save humanity. It's generally they do condemn suicide, as we all know. Most people say that this begins with Augustine. And Augustine says, look, if the Decalogue says thou shalt not kill, then that applies to yourself as well. So most Christians now, Protestant and Catholic, follow the Augustinian view that it's a violation of the commandment not to kill anybody, and that includes yourself. What's interesting is as you read the people Augustine is fighting with, many of them were very focused on martyrdom, and some of them were Gnostics, and Gnostics are a heterogeneous group with very different beliefs among themselves, but many of them believed that physicality was a curse and that escape from physicality was a blessing. The Donatists, who Augustine smashes and stamps out in a particularly characteristic Augustinian way, had rumors about them that they would actually waylay travelers and tell the traveler they would kill the traveler unless the traveler martyred the Donatist. If you don't kill me to send me to heaven, I will cut your head off. That's the type of rumor that spread about the Donatists. Whether they actually did so, who knows? Augustine was the one who got to write that history, and he was the one who vanquished them. But it does speak to the fact that martyrdom is a particular form of willing your own death in very specific contexts. Now, modern technomedicine, and I admit that I am a representative of that, has blurred the lines between life and death. I wanted to spend some more time on these slides, but got called urgently by a colleague to postpone, we hope, for several decades, that passage. And it's very clear that we currently have blurred the lines and have been able to get people through things that would have taken them earlier in our history. As a consequence, we can reverse most of the stuff that used to kill people in their teens, 20s, and 30s. And now often we face in our 70s, 80s, and 90s a protracted decline or a prolonged terminal illness. And what's happened over the last about 35 or 40 years in the West is that people have begun to say, no, I do not want advanced life support when it's my time to go, which is a radical restructuring from about 3 or 4 decades when the assumption was that no matter what, life defined as the beating heart must be continued. Now, people have begun to advocate over the last about 20 years the possibility that individuals should have the option of ending life by their choice as long as they are not depressed or driven to it by psychiatric illness and have been confirmed usually by 2 independent physicians as having less than 6 months to live. And that is physician-assisted suicide. It's not the same thing as Kevorkian. Kevorkian is a bit of a polemicist who is extended beyond that. But when we talk about physician-assisted suicide, we mean an individual without mental illness driving them to the decision who have had confirmed by independent medical authorities that they have fewer than 6 months to live, who decide, rather than suffer through the dwindling and the indignity of the loss of my autonomy and bodily functions and the pain, I would like to exit now. That is physician-assisted suicide. The Netherlands is the area where it's been best known and best studied. It was practiced for probably 25 or 30 years before a law in 2002 made it formally legal. In the Netherlands, they actually allow euthanasia, and that means specifically that whereas in physician-assisted suicide, the patient is the one to administer the life-terminating medication, in euthanasia, someone other than the patient administers that medication. And this euthanasia generally is somebody who has advanced disease, lapses into coma. Had always been quite clear that if I'm ever in a coma, I want this to end, and then it's administered by someone else. They have mandatory reporting, and Belgium has followed suit. Those are the 2 areas that have explicit laws in Europe, and it accounts for about 4% of the deaths nationally in the Netherlands. What's interesting, and I want to leave you in this section of the talk with the sense that one important side effect of physician-assisted suicide is that in the Netherlands, after the law passed, people did a lot better job at helping people live through the face of terminal illness. So attention to pain, attention to indignity, attention to autonomy actually increased even among those who decided not to commit physician-assisted suicide. In the United States, the Oregon Death with Dignity Act was enacted in 1997. No euthanasia is allowed. It specifically is physician-assisted suicide, also mandatory reporting. They've now reported on it, and it's overwhelmingly quite affluent people, middle-aged or older, who are either diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease or with a cancer. It's very rare for other groups to take advantage of it. And Washington has just passed a similar law. Here's a graphic from one of the reports from Oregon. This is the number of people annually who receive the prescription for the secobarbital. In the state of Oregon, that amounts to about 80 people. About half of them actually want to have the option, if it ever reaches the point of intolerability, so request the medication, but never do consume it. And then about half, about 40 per year, will actually take the medication, fall asleep, and not wake up. What's interesting, and unfortunately this graphic is imperfect, they interviewed physicians in Oregon after they had some experience with this law, and what they found, the darker shading is generally better. What they found is that in this milieu, even those who did not write a prescription for secobarbital were much more comfortable sitting with people and hearing them and talking about what comes next in their experience in the face of terminal illness. So even when they don't give the medication, they're better at counseling people who are facing imminent passage. So that's the basic ethical, descriptive introduction to what we're talking about. Now, what would it mean for a Latter-day Saint viewpoint to be expressed in this debate, which has overwhelmingly been framed in terms of Christian, primarily Catholic sensibilities, because Catholics, I think, are better at clarifying moral law than the very diffuse Protestantism. But Protestants have generally followed Catholics very closely on this. And then the secular view. There's not been any sense of a particularly Mormon voice. Yeah, the General Handbook of Instructions, which is the ecclesial organizational canon for the church, says that euthanasia is deliberately putting to death a person suffering from an incurable condition or disease, and they include so-called assisted suicide within euthanasia and indicate that it is strictly forbidden. Of note, they donated to a campaign against the Oregon law and against the Washington law, as well, as I recall. So felt that it was a moral position and one that deserved to be discussed politically and publicly as well. I want to browse through some of the themes that I think are relevant within the LDS tradition for framing this, and we'll go through them one by one. One is the divine or perfectionist anthropology, which is the notion that humans and God are of the same species. The next is the image of personal revelation. The other is the close association between embodiment and salvation, which is not really present in much of the rest of Christianity. Then there's our famed pragmatism, our atheological flexibility, that I think is probably relevant to this discussion. Talk a little bit about sacramental universalism and then close on the Mormon ideas about what's called the sanctity of life, which represents primarily the Catholic understanding that you're never allowed to participate in suicide. Now, in order to understand these discussions, I think we need to understand providence. Providence is the notion that God directs terrestrial life. God is responsible for what happens. Tragedies and blessings are indications of God's will, his punishments or rewards for behaviors, or his goals for our improvement. It's an ancient view, and it's one that persists within Mormonism. And it relates to trying to understand what is on God's mind. In the 19th century, they used the phrase afflicting providences to describe premature deaths, times when people they thought ought not to have left, left nevertheless. And fundamentally, the notion behind providence and death is that God is allowed, and not humans, to decree the times and seasons of our existence. And that's a basically familiar notion. Not all practicing Latter-day Saints endorse it, but I think all are familiar with the notion. What happens is you end up in these very strange, and sometimes very strained, theologies of God's love. The classic example is one Lester Bush adduced in a very interesting treatment 20 years ago, and talked about a woman dying of cancer with small children. And she said, "Stop telling them that God wants me to serve a mission on the other side. A mission on the other side is not more important to me than my children. Don't tell them that. It's not true." So you can end up in these strange moments as we try to bring providence and God's will to explain things that are tragic and difficult to understand. What's interesting to me as we reflect now in the 20th and 21st centuries in the West is that we don't entirely mean that the decrees of God are to be obeyed, right? Because we hire people like me to postpone the final encounter with God as long as we possibly can figure out. And I feel like I've done a very good job of work if I have postponed what appeared to be the decreed time of passage of someone for 20, 30, 50, 80 years. That's when I wake up in the morning, I think, I want to postpone death to the extent I can, if it will give people some shot at being together on earth. So it's very clear that for us, we routinely postpone death medically, right? I mean, it's almost automatic. And it's very strange when somebody says, "No, I have a treatable but fatal medical condition. It's my time to go." We step back. We don't know what to do. We think, are they crazy? What's going on, right? So it's definitely unidirectional in terms of how we allow providence to decree our time for leaving. Now, could the opposite occur? I don't want to think about martyrdom, saving a child in Revelation. We'll do that a little later at the top. But it seems to me that there may be actually times that we feel comfortable saying that we will make an active choice that moves us into the next life sooner than we would otherwise because we think we have a compelling reason. Now, the question of providence comes down to the question of divine power and human agency. Mormons are not Calvinists. Some Mormons are Calvinists, I apologize. But mostly we think we're probably not Calvinists. And when we hear that humans are depraved, powerless, meritless creatures, despised by an angry God, we think that sounds very strange. We actually believe that we're participants in the work of salvation, and that we are the same species as God. And it's something that Joseph Smith clearly preaches. In different sectors of Mormonism, it has different play. But I think most of us, as Latter-day Saints for at least a few years, are aware of that kind of a notion that human beings are good inherently. Well, the question is whether the implications of that mean that there will be times that human will have a claim on God, that there will be a time that we can ask God for something and have it delivered. The foundational scripture of the Book of Mormon indicates that there were at least one, and if not several, prophets who received the ability to speak for God, that their human will was allowed exercise. The other thing that's interesting is we believe that there are, or many of us do, believe that there are eternal laws that exist above God and humanity that may influence the relationships that we have with God. I'm going to talk about personal revelation as well. It's a very important part of Mormonism. We have an open canon. We have a very open canon. There are naysayers that wish we had a new doubling in the length of the Doctrine and Covenants every 10 years, and we don't have that. But we clearly have an open canon, a sense in which President Monson and others can extend Scripture, even now. We also have an image of our church leaders as actively prophets in the tradition of the Old Testament. And we have a belief that we can pray and receive directed guidance from God. Most Protestants up until recently believed that God could remind you and show you his love and influence you through an awareness of the correct reading of Scripture, but did not believe that the kinds of personal revelations that we describe as Latter-day Saints were really something that could continue to happen. So this is a very important theme for us, and we'll think through in the thought experiments what that might mean. Then there's embodiment and salvation. Those of you that don't do religious studies, we are funky when we are placed against other Christian traditions when it comes to our beliefs about embodiment. And God bless us, I love this part of the Latter-day Saint tradition, but it is very distinctive. We believe that our identities precede and succeed mortality. Who we are today is also who we were before we were ever born, and who we will continue to be after we're gone. And that kind of continuity of identity may be quite relevant to decisions about how long we spend on Earth. What's interesting is we believe that Earth is a brief training period. Now, other groups certainly believe that Earth is a training period. We believe that it's a uniquely influential time in the development of us as eternal individuals that plays out through the eternities. So there's a sense in which it's a crux. It's very brief. It's a blip if you look at the timeline of our existence. But it's an extremely influential blip. And the never embodied can't be saved. That's very clear in Joseph Smith's thought. Then we also have the sense that if a child passes before age of 8, then their embodiment has been accomplished. They don't need a new try. There are some threads in Mormon tradition that suggests that maybe in the millennial paradise they might have a new revision. That's probably mostly meant to explain infant death. I think most people would think a 7-year-old that died has done her time in mortality. And we also have individuals with profound cognitive impairment. And most Latter-day Saints, I think, believe that patients or individuals with profound cognitive impairment who pass at the age of 50 don't need to then repeat the experience of embodiment, even though they did not have a will that was tested by exercise of agency in the way we usually associate with the mortal period. And then we have this very interesting providential narrative that I described in Lester Bush's chapter, where we say somebody's needed in the other world. We have a very clear sense that there's more to the other world than just the post-mortal praise of God. That just as we have tasks and missions as mortals, we have tasks and missions as immortals, and we can be called to them. That's a very common folk theological idea within Mormonism. Pragmatism and flexibility. Here in the same General Handbook of Instructions, the church officially says, when dying becomes inevitable, you don't have to go through futile life support therapies. It's okay to say, no, please stop. That's not always true for all Catholics. There are clearly canon law arguments that you really do need to go until the heart stops beating, no matter what. And Mormons, even in the General Handbook of Instructions, do have a certain flexibility. And that's something that's often noted. The people that worry about whether we're theological or not do describe that we're more flexible by not having canon law, by not having strict theology. Sacramental universalism, I want to mention, that's a lot of fancy words. That basically means that through the temple and the adoption theology of the temple, we all can be brought to the family of heaven at the end. And the problem with that is, if that's really true, well, why wouldn't you leave early? And there is substantial folklore, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean in the sense that it's disseminated through word of mouth many decades after it was reported to have happened, in which Charles Lowell Walker remembers Woodruff remembering that Joseph Smith had talked to him 35 years before about this, that has since become an established part of the Mormon canon. And the basic story is that Joseph Smith said, if you could see how glorious the Telestial Kingdom was, you'd commit suicide to get there. And Woodruff is trying to explain, well, how can that be? And he says that the Lord in his wisdom has implanted the fear of death in every person that they may cling to life and thus accomplish the designs of their creator. It's an interesting image, right? We really don't believe very much in a hell. There's sort of a hell, but not so much. We believe in a lesser degree of glory, but a glorious place nevertheless. And what does that mean exactly? If life after life is so wonderful, even for people who are horrible and morally corrupt, why would we desire to stay here for so long? And that's an interesting, complex problem. Woodruff's solution is that God told us not to want to die to prevent us rushing off to get a B- in the afterlife. That's one way of reading it. I've told Blair he needs to finish this up. He's done a very good job of tracking this folklore, and I'm hoping he'll submit it to one of the Mormon Studies journals so we'll have a definitive treatment. Blair did the legwork to track this down. And what about the sanctity of life? That's really where the business has been in terms of Catholic and Protestant treatments of this. It's the notion that life is sacred. That's a relatively unobjectionable claim. And it gives us common political cause with conservative religious groups. It reflects a strongly held belief of most people. We really do believe life ought to be sacred. And there's something almost inherent in being a human who's conscious that says life ought to be preserved. What's interesting is life is about time, right? Since all of us are mortal, what we mean by life is measured in amounts of time spent conscious and mortal. Because we all die ultimately, right? If we die when we're 25 or we die when we're 80, we were still alive and we still died. The difference was in time. This is hard to sort of figure out. Every life that's saved in an emergency room in an intensive care unit is, in point of fact, a death postponed. A gloriously postponed, we hope, but postponed. And one of the problems that to me is most pressing is that few groups can be trusted to figure out when the sanctity of life ought to be violated in a particular instance. I want to go to some thought experiments now. Thought experiments about providence. Zina, a loved name in Mormon circles, is an 80-year-old woman who has advanced breast cancer, is getting chemotherapy, and goes to sleep one night, the night before her anniversary with her husband, who's been dead now for some 20 years, and she dies in her sleep, doesn't suffer at all. She's gone. Probably had 4 weeks to live before that, 4 painful weeks. How do we explain this problem? Is it a blessing or a curse?
Blessing.
Any votes for curse? Any votes for punishment?
Who would want to keep her alive under those circumstances? What? what kind of unfinished business would outweigh the amount of pain?
Right, right. If it turned out that if she could have survived one more day, and if she had, then her children, who were desperately poor because of a childhood leukemia, would have inherited $2 million, and that would have saved their lives, then we could construct a narrative of punishment. But by and large, imminent death, imminent painful death, replaced by a painless passage. We think of that as a blessing from God. What do we do about Penny? She's got three kids, she's 28, and some expletive, you know, drives the SUV over her, drunk, presumably.
It's a tragedy.
It's a tragedy, right? There's no blessing in this. This is a punishment. Well, do we call it a punishment? We don't, because she doesn't seem culpable, right? So that is a tragedy. Well, what does tragedy mean in Providence?
Someone misusing their free agency, which hurts you.
Right, right.
In Providence, that doesn't come in.
Right. So if we were back, if we were living still when Calvinism reigned supreme, then that tragedy would probably be a punishment of her husband for loving her too much. That's most commonly how they solve this problem.
Or God taking mysterious action that humans cannot understand.
They would also attempt to make that frame. But if you read the Calvinists, 18th century into 19th century, when something like this happened, they called it an afflicting casualty or an afflicting providence. And they generally thought it's God telling me that I was loving another person too much instead of loving him. That's very foreign to us now. We don't have a way to make providence get around this. Let's talk about personal revelation for a minute. Phil, 22-year-old Marine, has a moment of just instant inspiration that an enemy combatant is going to kill his buddy in the, they're not in trenches anymore, but his buddy in the, those tank Hummer things. And he jumps in front of his friend and dies. What was that?
Selfless act.
A selfless act.
Heroic.
It was heroic, right?
Something his family could be proud of.
Okay.
Unless, of course, you say that he was violating the prime directive, which is to preserve your life at all costs.
That's right.
But we don't believe that.
Right.
Yeah. What if instead of being a Marine, was a Nazi who was protecting his fellow Nazi friend from a Jewish person?
Absolutely. What if the person he jumped?
Still a hero.
Yeah. What if the person he jumped in front of turned out to be the next? Who's that guy that blew up Oklahoma, the ex-army guy?
Timothy McVeigh.
What if the person he saves turned out to be the next Timothy McVeigh?
God has a weird sense of humor.
Yeah, absolutely. But this is a moment where an inspiration to great heroism, when followed, hastened Phil's death. Probably hastened Phil's death by decades. Actually, I do think it's heroic. I agree. I think let's think through what these
are. Cirrhosis of the liver because
correct.
I don't have a living streak.
It's hard to.
So it's even heroic when the Nazis do it, or just when we do it?
Well, that's an interesting question that let's get to in the Q&A if we still have time.
So, in other words, you don't want to answer it?
No, because I.
You never get to that point where you want to answer it. You know, that's just looking up. If you don't want to answer it, I understand.
I am happy to not answer it.
Okay.
What's it?
5 more minutes left.
Okay. Let's talk about John. John has advanced pancreatic cancer and prays for guidance. What comes next, God? I'm dying and I'm in pain, and what do you want me to do next? And he has a clear answer from God. Go to Washington or Oregon and get a prescription for Sacubitril. I want you home. What do we tell John? Don't have to answer this one because we've got Jean, which changes things just a little bit. Jean, same age, same diagnosis. He prays. And for him, he says, God says, your wife Susan is being destroyed by this. She cannot bear how miserable you are, and she loves you, and she would never wish for you to die. Never. But she's on the verge of collapse, staying awake with you as your body falls apart. And she's going to go bankrupt. it's okay for you to look out for Susan and to go, what do we advise Jean? What are the differences between John and Jean? And does his worry over Susan change the question of whether it's okay? Can you get personal revelation that it's time to go? It's an interesting, difficult question. Now, a few questions related to an individual named Dominic. He's the hero of a short story I wrote some years ago. I sort of like him. He's a sweet guy. He's a D minor in some kind of Cambodia spectrum place. And his daughter, Sunil, has gone into a minefield. She's trying to please her dad. And Dominic rushes in, saves her, but loses his legs. How do we interpret that?
Heroic.
That's a heroic, right? That is a hero father who says, I love my daughter, and I will take care of my daughter. What happens if he fails, and someone else saves Sunil? And in retrospect, they would have saved Sunil anyway.
But he wouldn't have known that.
He wouldn't have known that. So his decision at this point, what matters is the decision.
You have to try.
But is this his will?
I perceive that I might, through the possible sacrifice of my life, save my daughter. And that is what matters. That's a partial question to the Nazi answer that I deflected. That at the moment of decision, I feel that I can save another human being, no matter who they are, and I decide to take that action. What if it's his dog, Parak? He loves the dog. It is a dog, right? Is this heroism or foolhardy suicidality?
Or both.
Or both. Or both. What has to weigh in the balance before we're allowed to choose to take an extremely risky action? What about this? What if Dominic has liver cancer? Got hepatitis B when he was a kid. Now has liver cancer. Has just a few weeks to months to live. And he knows that. And he says, look, I am expendable. You need me to make the village safer by digging up the mines. I will do it. And he goes out and he gets 19 out and the 20th explodes and he dies.
It's
sounds good to me.
Sounds heroic to me. Right? But a heroism born of a certain realism about the limited time that we have.
And not an impulse decision. Obviously, you have time to make a different decision.
What do we think about Martha is dying of advanced heart failure, and her daughter Mary is providing round-the-clock care. And Martha feels like Mary is going to collapse. She just can't bear it anymore. And so Martha says, look, why am I taking these 5 pills and have one of these little implantable defibrillator shock boxes in? I want it. But what am I doing? I'm ready to go. I've had a good life. Turns off the defibrillator and stops taking her pills and dies.
Good for Martha.
Is it? Is that different from Jean, who requests the sacubarbital? Remember, the Jean is similarly worried about his wife, Susan.
Well, this doesn't involve Mary's permission in the same way that Susan would be involved in the decision.
To me, it matters if she talks to Mary or not, or discusses it with her. Because I think to do something heroic for someone else without knowing that person who wants that, or that will be actually positively affected by it, doesn't seem very good to me. It seems like it's important to really know what that person really wants.
Caretaker's never
going
to say, I want you to die.
Yeah. Correct. So we have a young person and we have an older person. And I think what happens as you age is you realize that those are the kinds of conversations that have a forced outcome. We're done.
Are you pretty much close to arriving?
Probably.
About 5 minutes left.
Okay.
Keep going. This is going.
Would you guys rather do a formal separate Q&A or keep moving on through the thought experiments? Okay.
The thought experiments are good.
So what's interesting is if you have these conversations, 99.9% of the caretakers will say, look, I'm doing this because I love you and I want the time with you. So it's a kind of conversation that you think ought to have happen.
It displaces the decision onto the caretaker. Is that a fair thing to do?
Because a lot of times you do things for people they don't want you to do, but you're doing it for them, and it's the right thing to do.
Correct. Correct. And we believe that the Spirit can help us sort through these very complex situations. And I hope we pray about it.
But not alone, necessarily. I mean, as I just said, we say we should consult with the bishop, we should consult with our family and our loved ones together to make this decision. It's not just an individual decision for ourselves, because our actions affect others. And so we do have to, I think, take their choices and their desires into account.
For lack of time, I pulled that section out of the talk, but this is coming back to a very Platonic and Aristotelian idea that we're not all alone in the world, and that our decisions occur in the context of other people. And Mormon communitarianism does provide precisely that kind of an answer. In practice, it's very hard to have those kinds of conversations, but I have seen people have them and say, not give me the secobarbital, but let me stop the chemotherapy. And those can be very difficult conversations to have, but ultimately they can work. But unfortunately, you're never able to say, and I don't like what I see it doing to you. Because then that suddenly puts onto the caretaker the onus that mom killed herself because she thought I couldn't be bothered to take care of her, right? That's how, however mutantly it gets translated in our minds, that's the impress that it leaves upon our hearts. I want to talk just a moment about sliding slopes, and this is what worries me. You can see that in Mormonism, I actually find a fair number of themes that would support a notion of under inspiration, in consultation with the family, taking into consideration a variety of factors, that it might be okay to endorse something like saying, God has called me and it's time, and I'm going to go to bed tonight and not wake up. But I think there's a reason to be thoughtfully skeptical of physician-assisted suicide, thoughtfully and compassionately skeptical. And what's interesting to me is that passive euthanasia is a term that was used in the 60s and 70s to refer to stopping undesired life support therapies, saying, I don't want to be on the ventilator anymore. I don't want to have life support tubes attached to me. If I can't live naturally, I don't want to continue. That was actually called passive euthanasia until the 90s. It's very interesting. And you go back and you read the ethical literature in the 60s and 70s, and they were having the kinds of conversations that we have now about physician-assisted suicide with regard to just stopping life support. And it took the Supreme Court in the 70s and other state Supreme Courts to give permission to say, no, it's okay to stop life support therapy that's not giving the benefits that are anticipated. And now in the 2000s, it's actually pretty routine. If people feel like there's no great advantage in terms of the quality of the time they'll have with anybody, most of our patients now will say, I don't want to be hooked up to life support systems in a half coma for 7 weeks until I pass away. Get out of my way. There are regional variations. When I was practicing in Boston, there was a very traditional Catholic community in which that was less common. Here among the Latter-day Saints, it's much more common to have the idea that, you know, when it's time, it's time. And we saw in the General Handbook of Instructions that we're allowed, even based on that canon law such as it exists. What's interesting is when you couple it with treatments for physical suffering, morphine or Ativan or Valium, it does speed their death slightly. The alternative is a painful, frustrating, discomforting, in that final sense, passage. So Catholic canon law allows what's called double effect. You can treat symptoms. The symptom can't be consciousness. It has to be pain, struggle to breathe, aches. You can do that with the best medicine available. And if that medicine has a side effect that there's a slight hastening of your passage, that's okay as long as there's not a medicine that would do it better without that side effect, and the medicine's the only way to treat that. So currently in 2010, that is allowed in most states, and that tends to be how people want to go. What's interesting, though, is that's moved in 30 years from passive euthanasia that has to go to the Supreme Court to a solution that families often volunteer without any prompt. They say, look, you can have 24. Routinely, people say, I'll let you run your life support for 48 hours. If you haven't fixed me by then, it's time to go. So there's been a cultural shift that's happened just over the very recent period. Another thing that worries me in terms of sliding slopes is psychiatric screening. It's depressing to have terminal cancer. It just is. And distinguishing true organic depression that clouds your ability to think logically about your plight from the sadness that comes with facing your own demise can be very difficult. The laws all require that people be screened for depression. Because if you can treat the organic depression and they feel well and have sacred time with their family for the last 2.5 months, it would seem that physician-assisted suicide is probably not the right answer. Whereas if they're not depressed and they feel strongly and rationally it's time to go, then it's time to go. There's some evidence that this doesn't always get done. It's such a hard thing to talk about that not everybody carefully screens for depression. And then I think that there need to be barriers to exit. I think that there is something so sacred about the time we spend together as mortals that there need to be certain cultural barriers to abandoning that. And the reason I think that matters is that there are master narratives. There are stories about what human beings are and what we are that need to be told to allow us to continue through mortality in a way that keeps society working. The classic one that you will laugh about is that parenting small children is a good and happy thing. That is a master narrative that must continue or society is going to collapse. Right? So we have to actively ignore evidence to the contrary in order to keep things going. And there's a master narrative that I think is very important, that our time as human mortal beings is sacred and never to be repeated. And we ought to be very slow to walk away from it. And my fear is that using this very specific case of physician-assisted suicide as the way to crack the nut of those barriers to exit may lead to very important negative consequences in terms of how we live our lives. And I guess my conclusion is that this master narrative, that physical existence itself is not a burden or a tragedy, that the consciousness is not itself a burden, is a very important master narrative. And it's a master narrative that talks about the ways we interact together. So as I've reflected on this, and I'm open to lots of input, although I apologize this took longer than I meant, is that there are very good reasons within the Mormon tradition to believe that the very specific instance of physician-assisted suicide could be justifiable on the basis of our theology and folk theology. I think it's probably the wrong move. I do think, though, that an act of denial of physician-assisted suicide entails very specific obligations, right? I think that our master narrative of life is ultimately probably incompatible with capital punishment. I don't mean to be one of these activists about it. I recognize that there are competing master narratives of eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But my sense is that as you reflect on these master narratives, we ought not to terminate each other's lives. We ought not to terminate our own lives. That capital punishment seems to me ultimately untenable. And the other thing is that if we deny physician-assisted suicide, ethically we are required to look after people with terminal illness. We can't walk away from them because they got weird body fluids coming in. We can't walk away from them because they've lost their awareness and their social graces. We can't walk away from them because the pain of their possible separation from us is so great that we can't see straight. We can't abandon them. We have to be with them. So... That is my collection of thoughts about physician-assisted suicide from a Mormon perspective. And we probably have time. Awesome. Now for questions. I have not forgotten the Nazis. No one ever forgets the Nazis.
To introduce the 10 minutes we have for questions, we would like you to step up to the microphone and speak clearly in the mic to ask a question. An interesting side note, a little bit about providence and coincidence, is about 2 weeks ago I saw the posted online what different sessions were open, and I wrote to Mary Ellen and I said, I suggested like 8 different sessions that I would be interested in chairing just to help out and fill in where people had not, didn't have someone else that was already chairing the session. And this particular session was not one that would be something that would normally be along my lines of interest. They're more often Mormon history, church history, those things. And because I watched the movie You Don't Know Jack about Kevorkian, that this one just struck my mind, and so I just marked it down. Yesterday I received some disturbing personal news about some family member, and so from about noon on, I was just preoccupied with that. And then at 7 o'clock at night, I received from a friend a text message, and it just stepped it up yet another notch. He wrote to me and said that he'd been struggling with depression, and he asked me to please help him end his life. And so I immediately called him back, and he didn't answer, and I texted him and then everything. And so for a period of about 4 hours until I contacted another friend of his via Facebook and was able to find out that he struggles from time to time about suicide and depression. And I was very, very panicked that he was going to make a very bad decision, and it may be a chemical process. And even though he's seeking counseling, it just really brought this topic very much to life for me. And so for the first question I'd like to ask, and it's not really related to that, it was just one of those things about you're talking about like what things are coincidental and what things are providence, and it just kind of happened that something that normally isn't in my venue suddenly became very, very prominent within the last 24 hours. But the question that I would have asked, 2 days ago, about the same topic.
Harry, what happened to your friend?
Oh, he's all right. It was just... Sorry. I knew that.
No, you're good at building suspense. Keep it up.
So the question I have, when you talk about the ending of life, the overlap obviously becomes the beginning of life and the termination of the beginning of life. And so, well, not to get on a whole different tangent, what things do you see overlapping between the termination of life and abortion as far as termination before life really gets started? And just quickly, I don't want to go off a whole different tangent, but what do you see as some of the commonalities between those two experiences? And at that point in time, when you finish answering my question, step up to the mic and we'll go for another 7 minutes or so with questions and answers.
So if I can just make sure it's clear in my mind, I'm being asked to comment on how to determine whether God is involved in a life, abortion, and Nazis. In less than 7 minutes. I'm teasing. I'm going to answer the first question as a believer and in a devotional vein. And in my own walk with God and with faith, I prefer the name Emmanuel. God is with us. And it's my belief that what we think of as coincidence, providence, minor miracles, these kinds of juxtapositions are a reminder of God's earnest desire and commitment to be with us through the experience of mortality. I do not personally, as a believer, endorse traditional providence. I have not found it to be, for me, a productive theological act. What I have found productive is seeking out God as I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. I have not found it productive to try to find out why God created a valley of shadow of death, or how it is that I came to be barefoot with a giant blister walking through it, but to seek God in it, and to seek God in the beautiful times and in the sacred moments of juxtaposition and in the difficult battles when things seem quite alone. So that's, I'm only going to answer that devotionally, not medically or academically, which would have a different answer. As far as abortion, you're correct, that's often associated in the press. One question is whether it is to strategic advantage politically, and I think it probably is to strategic advantage politically, given how nervous people feel about the notion of suicide. Juxtaposing that to abortion may give anti-abortion polemicists much more ammunition. However, it's a very natural association. It's a question about desires to limit the time we have together as conscious mortals. And when it's framed that way, it applies much more broadly and perhaps more perilously to the question even of family planning, or the question of how large a family should we expect to have at a given moment. I will say that culturally, we do not have the same reaction to a two-week miscarriage that we do to a term stillbirth. This is true across cultures. Even a two-week miscarriage is generally very sad. A one-week miscarriage is almost never sad because it's only perceived as a slightly late menstruation, which is itself interesting. But a 2 to 4 week or a 6 week miscarriage is an emotional assault and a tragedy, but is not culturally identical to a stillbirth, which in turn is not culturally identical to a child born with congenital disease who only lives for a few weeks, which in turn is not the same as a child fully sentient who dies at the age of 7 or 10. There does seem to be, in our sensibility about what it means for life to not last as long as we had hoped, or never to start, a very contextual feeling. It matters who you are and at what phase you are in development. So a pro-abortion answer would say that abortion is a form of family planning, and that the life that could have been is not the same as a life that was. An anti-abortion activist would say that life is life. And I think they're separable and complexly interrelated. As for the Nazi thing, that's extremely complex. Most people, I think, would probably say if the individual who threw himself in front of a bullet felt that that decision was necessary to save lives, that was okay, even Nazi against Nazi. If the Nazi made the decision to throw himself in front of a superior officer in the hopes that that superior officer could then kill 500,000 Jews single-handedly, most people would probably say that that was not an act of moral heroism. So I think for most of us, the question is, what is your intent as you sacrifice yourself? And if that intent is worthy and admirable, it's heroic. And if it is not worthy or admirable, then it's not heroic. So we got through, is God involved in our lives, abortion, and Nazi? What other questions?
You spoke during the PowerPoint about there was an example of a Mormon doctor who doesn't want to give Subarbital. I was wondering if you could talk about that, about the ethics of the physician side of what a doctor or someone who's using medicine, how he should deal with these issues if a patient wants to take a course of action, and just generally how do you navigate it as a physician of faith or a medical person of faith?
That's a wonderful question. Peggy Batten, in her latest book from Oxford, which is maybe 2005 and has a picture of Seneca on the cover, I'm bad with names, has an entire section, an essay, treating this question. Many of you will also know that there has been a movement generally among anti-family planning activists to allow physicians to refuse to prescribe oral contraception. On the art, these are called conscience clauses. So those are actively being discussed and advocated. Many of you will not know, and I did not know until I gave a talk on ethics to a medical group a year ago, that in the state of Utah, you cannot be sued as a doctor if you actively lie to an expecting couple, if the only harm associated with that lie is that they chose not to terminate a pregnancy. So it actually, you are safe. And the Supreme Court, in a split decision with Chief Justice Durham dissenting, upheld it as constitutional. If you diagnose Down syndrome or anencephaly or any of a range of devastating congenital intrauterine anomalies, and you tell the parents that there's no problem at all, because you're afraid they might terminate the pregnancy, if the child is born, they can't even sue you for the emotional pain of not having been prepared. That's Utah. That's the state legislature.
What year was that?
2002, I think, was the court case.
How many states?
We're the ones that made it to the Supreme Court because we were most strident about it. There are about, I think there are about six or seven states that have similar legislation. And that's related to this concern that what does a physician do? So Peggy Batten argues that if you are not comfortable providing a particular type of therapy, then you actually need to gracefully and graciously arrange for the provision of that care from someone else. But Peggy argues that doctors don't have that luxury if they know the patient well. Because it's one thing to tell somebody you've known for 30 years, who's treated you through it all. It's one thing to tell them it's time to go and have them let you go. And it's another thing to meet a complete stranger in a white jacket and have that conversation. So she argues that you ought to be forced as a physician to do it. I think my view as a physician of faith is that most often what people say is only part of what's on their mind. And often a request for secobarbital is a request to talk about how to navigate the last 3 months. So my response to those kinds of questions is to clear my schedule and sit down and we talk and we cry and we think. And so far, 100% of the time, people have actually wanted a busy doctor just to sit down and be a human being with them as they figure this out. Now, if I were to reach an insoluble point, I think I probably would, at the end of that big investment of time and energy, advise them to consider the state of Oregon if they felt that was in their best interest. And I did not have reason to think that they had psychiatric disease. But that is one of the deep moral crises of being a healthcare provider.
Can someone outside of Oregon actually go to Oregon to get a doctor there? I thought you had to be an Oregon resident.
Yeah, I think you have to be there for a certain period of time. You can't just drive up to the 7-Eleven and get the secobarbital. But as I recall, you can integrate. And often people have enough advance notice that if that's something they're considering, they might go. But it's a very difficult situation.
We want to thank Samuel Brown for a very articulate presentation, and this concludes this particular session.